Hello, everybody, and welcome to the premiere. You are listening to radio.dominican.edu, and you are here with DJ Jazz. Tonight here on the premiere, we're going to be going in-depth and behind the scenes on some big Hollywood movies, specifically one movie on this show tonight. We're going to be going into Steven Spielberg's Jaws, his first major production, and one that almost ended his career, which doesn't really happen a lot anytime around nowadays. So, just a few quick things. Jaws was actually based off a novel by Peter Benchley, and he actually in turn helped write the screenplay for the film. It was released in 1975, was the highest grossing film of all time, until Star Wars, which came out 2 years later. The story is about a man-eating shark, which is off the coast of Amity Island. Amity is a fictional summer town on the northern east coast of the United States. The problem is the shark, along with killing innocent bystanders and swimmers, is cutting into the funds that would normally go through the town during the summer festivals around 4th of July. So they contract Captain Quint to kill the shark, and him, along with Chief of Police Brody and an oceanographer named Hooper, go out and try and kill the shark. And I'd like to give a little spoiler alert. I know the movie came out in 1975, but not a lot of people have seen a couple movies. You'd be surprised how many people haven't seen really good movies. So, spoiler alert, the ending happens when Quint is killed by the shark and Hooper escapes and is trapped, and Martin is forced to shoot the shark, and the shark explodes due to an oxygen tank which was lodged in its mouth. So that's the basic plot of the story. It's a good movie. I recommend you watch it if you've never seen it, or if you have seen it, it's definitely a good one. But tonight we're going to be going behind the scenes on some of the early beginnings and how the movie formed into what it is today, other things of that nature. So we're going to start at the very humble beginnings of Richard D. Zanuck and David Brown. These two men were producers at Universal Pictures, and they each separately found the book. Brown found it because his wife actually edited the literature section of Cosmopolitan magazine. They each read the book in a single night because they could not put it down, and they both agreed that it should be a movie. In fact, the Cosmopolitan article at the end said, "might make a good movie." So they purchased the rights in 1973 before the book was actually published, and they bought it for around $175,000, which today is around $0.93 million, so just under that. So Brown later claims if they had actually read the book twice, they would have never made the movie, because reading it, they would have realized all the potential problems and errors that would have come across. So, of course, Steven Spielberg is a great director. He's directed movies like Jurassic Park, Jaws, he's been a part of Star Wars. He's been a part of a lot of different movies, and he's gotten his pick to do whatever movie he feels fit because he's so credible today. So first, they actually considered a director named John Sturges, and John Sturges is famous for directing The Old Man and the Sea, which is a really, really old movie, and it's based off of the literature tale. I'm not sure if you've heard it. I've heard it in English class a couple different times. They gave the job originally to a man named Dick Richards, but they really grew irritated with him because in the early production, he had a habit of describing the shark in the story as looking like a whale or being a whale. So they really didn't like the fact that he was referring to it as a whale because they wanted it to be a horror film, and they didn't want it to be a copycat of Moby Dick or something like that, because there had been a movie at this point about Moby Dick, which starred Gregory Peck. And Gregory Peck is also in the movie version of To Kill a Mockingbird. He's a really great actor. So they didn't want to do a ripoff of Moby Dick. They wanted to do something new. They wanted to do it off of this book. So Spielberg had just finished his first project, which was called The Sugarland Express. And it was, you know, it was just like his first movie as a licensed director, so it wasn't anything too flashy. John Williams actually worked with him on that one too. I'm not sure everyone knows John Williams has a habit of working with Steven Spielberg on his movies and composing his movies. So Spielberg noticed the copy of the unreleased novel after they had a meeting, him, Brown, Zanuck, and a couple other producers, and he read it and he instantly fell in love with it, and he went up to them and asked them for the job, and he got signed to direct in 1973. But as the production date grew closer, he said he grew reluctant, and he considered actually leaving Universal and going to 20th Century Fox, which was a competing movie production center. The word escapes me. So he considered going to 20th Century Fox, but David Brown, convinced him to say, and he said, after Jaws, you can make all the films that you want. And that was really interesting to me, just because if you look at how Steven Spielberg's career flourished after that and how much success he has now today, that someone was able to call that all those years ago is crazy. And who knows, maybe he was just making the comment because he wanted him to stay, but it's incredible how, you know, that event can come about. So the film in the beginning was given an estimated budget of around $3.5 million. And they said the shooting schedule should be about 55 days. Spielberg wanted to stay with the basic plot of the book, and he especially liked the final 120 pages of the book, which is the shark hunt, in which Brody, Hooper, and Quint go out to catch and kill the shark. So along with Peter Benchley, who was the author, he helped provide the basic structure of the script, sort of just like the skeleton of it. Spielberg asked his friend Carl Gottlieb to help write, and Carl Gottlieb is actually a comedy writer, and he wanted to add some humor to the story because he was afraid that if they had marketed the movie as just a simple creature feature or a you know, bloodbath, you know, they didn't want it to be a dark sea hunt movie, something that, you know, that not a lot of people would want to see just because it's so violent, which ended up being a problem later, even though they edited the final production a lot. But so he called upon Carl Gottlieb to add some humor, and there is some good humor in the movie. There's a part where Brody is trying to make signs that say beach closed, because the beach has never been closed, so he needs to go to the hardware store in town and make signs that say beach closed by order of Amity PD. And he's in such a fluster because he's just filled out the report of the first shark attack that he spills the brushes all over himself and kind of makes a scene in the convenience store. And there's a scene where the three men are on the boat, and Quint is drinking a beer that he's just like cracked open with his thumb instead of using the metal pin. And so he cracks it open with his fingers, drinks it, and then he crushes it in his hand, and Hooper's been watching him. And so he looks over at him, and Hooper's been drinking water out of a styrofoam cup. And so he finishes the rest of his water and then just looks at Quint and crushes the styrofoam cup in his hands. And I think this in time in the movie was like either just after or just before when the first time they see the shark, or the first time the shark comes around the boat. And they actually don't see it the first time. Quint snags it on his line, on his fishing hook, and they don't see it because it dives under the boat to avoid capture. So, and the line snaps. Quint uses in the movie piano wire, because he talks about how piano wire, sharks can't bite through it, or like when they bite through it, it gets stuck in their throat. So he, as a shark fisherman, uses piano wire when he's fishing. And for this shark to be able to tear through that, you know, he tells them that it's a serious fish. And when the shark actually first does reveal itself, Hooper first says it's 20 feet. And 20 feet's big. 20 feet's, I mean, when you think about it, 20 feet is, it's like, oh, 20 feet. But if you measure out 20 feet, 20 feet's pretty big. And Quint looks at him and goes, 25, 3 tons of them. So that means this shark is 25 feet and 3 tons, and they've got three guys on a boat that's maybe the size of a classroom and a half here at the campus. And it's just, I don't know. the book really makes it sound good, but when you watch the movie and you see the shark, this huge 25-foot, 3-ton shark next to this boat, and you see how they size up next to each other, it's incredible. And it's awesome because, you know, Brody has the famous line, "You're gonna need a bigger boat." And if you watch that movie, that's gonna be the first thing that crosses your mind. So Benchley had written Jaws after reading about a sports fisherman. His name was Frank Mundus, and he captured a shark in 1964 when he was out fishing. And it was a really big shark. I think it was about maybe 17, 18 feet. I'm not quite sure. But according to Carl Gottlieb, the comedy writer, Quint was actually loosely based on Mundus, who wrote a book called Sports Fishing for Sharks. Sports Fishing for Sharks by Frank Mundus. And he read it for research about shark hunting. And that's where they got the inspiration about Quint's character. And Quint in the book was actually not a World War II vet. They had actually written that into the story. That was original to the story. And Quint's backstory as a survivor of World War II introduced a really nice monologue that Robert Shaw has in the movie about the USS Indianapolis. The USS Indianapolis was a submarine in World War II, and this submarine was designated to deliver the bomb, the nuclear bomb that was going to be dropped on Hiroshima. So they delivered it to the island where the Enola Gay would eventually take off, and on their way back, were hit by two torpedoes from a Japanese submarine, and they went down. And in the monologue, he talks about 1,100 men went into the water, and their mission was so secret that there was no distress signal, and they hadn't been listed overdue for about a week. So they did not get help for a long time. I forget what the final time they were out there was. But he says 1,100 men went into water, didn't see the first shark for a half an hour. And then he says at the end that only 316 men came out of the water. So that's all those men just to the sharks. Everybody else had already perished in the initial explosion and destruction of the vessel, the submarine. Those 1,100 men were cut down to 316 by those sharks. And so that's also what inspires Quint's hatred of these sharks, is because he was on the Indianapolis. So it only really fed to his backstory to add that part into the script. And it actually made it, I think it made the movie much better, because that monologue by Robert Shaw, who's a great Victorianly trained actor, he's an awesome actor and a scriptwriter, screenplay, I believe. And when he gives that monologue, you can only help but just sort of just stare and listen to what he has to say, because he really does capture you in that moment. And it's such a good part of the film. And then it's broken up just immediately after by some humor, which was, they start singing just like some songs. They've all been drinking, and they just start singing drinking songs in the cab of the boat. And right after, it's broken up by some horror, which is the shark comes and starts beating on the side of the boat. So in just those couple minutes of the actual screen time, you can see all these sort of different writing styles play out, which is the comedy, the seriousness, the nod to history, and the comedy. And the horror, apologies. All in just that one maybe 7-minute part of the movie. And it's just a great part that it always captures my attention. We're going to take a quick break here. We're going to go and put some music on. We'll be right back on the red carpet. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. All right, we're back here on radio.dominican.edu. You're listening to The Premiere. I am DJ Jazz. We are going to continue our talk that we were just having about Jaws and the making of and just behind the scenes of Jaws. So we're going to get into the casting portion of this. I've been talking about some actors such as Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, I haven't brought up, Roy Scheider. Those are the three main characters. So Spielberg didn't want big stars for the movie. He wanted somewhat anonymous performers. Like I said, these guys had sort of had some career before this. They had kind of each been in either a just recent movie or a movie that hadn't really gotten a lot of good reviews. So Spielberg had picked them up, and he thought it would help the audience believe that this was happening to people like you and me. If they were somewhat unknown actors, not big Hollywood well-known actors, it would help the audience sort of fall into the whole idea that this was happening to real people, or like help them believe this was actually happening in real life. He said that stars bring a lot of memories along with them, and those memories can sometimes corrupt the story, which I do find true. You do see some actors in other movies, you know, like Daniel Radcliffe, for perfect example. Daniel Radcliffe played Harry Potter for many, many years. He was Harry Potter. He was that guy. And then after he leaves, he has been in other movies that have done pretty well. He was in a horror movie, The Woman in Black, which was actually a really good horror movie. I do see, if you're a fan of horror movies, more in the sense that you like suspense and you like to be on the edge of your seat, not so much things just popping out at you all the time, but you really like to be held in suspense. The Woman in Black, excuse me, The Woman in Black is really good. It has to do about a man. It's really early in, I think, the 1900s, very beginning of the 1900s, and it has to do with a man who's settling the final proceedings of a house that's in the middle of, literally in the middle of a marsh, that the tide will roll in at the end of every day, and you will be stuck in the house overnight. So already it sounds creepy. But yeah, getting back on track, he didn't want actors that had come with a movie that was really successful and then people would only view that actor as the character from that movie. So he didn't want their characters from their previous movies to impede on what he was trying to do with Jaws. So he, most of the film, he also added that in his plans, the superstar of the movie was going to be the shark. The shark on screen would be the main character, the main actor, the main star of the movie, which it really is. I mean, you watch the movie today, and the shark kind of, you can tell it's fake. It's pretty animatronic and rickety looking. And if you watch Shark Week every year, or if you've just seen video of great whites, they really don't move like that, or at least they move a lot with a lot more fluidity. They don't really move so mechanical, like the shark they used for the movie. And there's actually some footage of a real shark that they got for the movie. And when you see them side by side, how the real shark is moving and how their shark, the mechanical shark, moves, it's not similar at all. It's very different. So the shark is the star of the movie, and Jaws, like the fish, has definitely gone down as a major movie villain. I mean, he is the villain technically. But when you watch it today, you can't help but just laugh a little bit at how fake the shark looks. That was the big thing, as the years went by, was the shark looks really fake, which it does, but I don't know. It's still a good movie. So Amity Island, which is the setting for Jaws, is not actually a real place. It was written in the book. So most of the film was actually shot in Martha's Vineyard, and many of the minor roles and just roles of townspeople in background, you know, just all the different people you see walking across the streets were actually just local residents of Martha's Vineyard. So the role of Brody, and so Brody, if you haven't seen the movie, Brody is the town's chief of police. And Amity isn't that big, and not much goes on there. It's like, it's the epitome of what a small town is. It's just, it's on the beach. And every summer, they get people from the mainland to come in and go on the beach and spend money. And they have a big 4th of July festival that attracts a lot of people. And so that's how they get their money, and they save that so that they can open their store or save their stores through the winter when no one really comes to the island except, you know, family and friends. So local residents play the role, filmed in Martha's Vineyard. The role of Brody was first offered to Robert Duvall, which Robert Duvall had been in The Godfather recently. And Charlton Heston was also asked about the role of Brody. And Charlton Heston, he's a really old school actor. He was like, he was in the Ten Commandments, which is a really old movie. And Roy Scheider became interested when he heard Spielberg talking to a screenwriter at a party they were both at. And they considered him, and they invited him out for an initial reading, but they just weren't sure if he was gonna fit the role, because the role of Brody is just the small town police chief. And Roy Scheider had just been in a movie where he was kind of this gunslinging, action-packed, you know, kind of guy. And, you know, they didn't, as Spielberg said before, they didn't want his previous work to translate over onto the film. But if you watch the movie, he does a really good job. He's a really terrific actor, terrific actor in the movie. That everyone is, I believe. So Zanuck and Brown had just finished The Sting with Robert Shaw. The Sting is also a very good movie. And he recommended him to Spielberg. And Shaw was a little apprehensive because he actually didn't like the book. He didn't like Jaws to begin with. But he was urged by his wife as well as some other family and friends, and he decided to go on with the role. So the performance of Quint, and if you've ever seen the movie, Quint is just very eccentric, and he's very closed-minded, and he's very just focused on what he does, which is he catches and kills sharks. So his performance was based off of a fellow cast member by the name of Craig Kingsbury, and he was a local fisherman. He was a farmer, and he was also a town eccentric. That's how people knew him. And he also got some of his performance from a local Martha's Vineyard mechanic and boat owner by the name of Lynn Murphy. They had kind of met him and talked to him on the course of setting up and filming there. And so he used some of this actual Martha's Vineyard inhabitants style in his acting. So George Lucas was the one who suggested Richard Dreyfuss. And Richard Dreyfuss plays the role of Matt Hooper, who is a marine biologist who comes to help the people of Amity try and get rid of the shark. And so George Lucas suggested him because of his work in American Graffiti, which had just recently come out. And because of how different the film was, Spielberg asked Dreyfuss not to read the novel. At this point, they had changed many different things to the novel and the book, because they are different. There were many different changes to the script, and as a result, the book, which you can read, you know, at a library or at a Barnes & Noble, and the movie, which you can watch, I think is on Netflix right now, actually, if you want to watch it later, are very different. Many different occurrences in the book, and many different fates of the characters have been changed, and it's just very different. It's a very different story, which was also one of the draw-ins when it initially came out, was because people could read the book and then they could see the movie, and they wouldn't be seeing or reading the same story. It was a different story on screen than it was when you read it at home. So It really drew people in, because it was a dynamite story. Like, if you read the book is really intense, and it really captures your attention. And then as soon as they decided to market both of them at the same time, so they decided they would market the movie, but whenever they brought up the movie, they would also have to bring up the book, and vice versa. So when people went out and watched the movie and read the book, they were able to engage in two different stories and be entertained either way. So it was just a very unique experience at the time. The role of Hooper was actually rewritten a lot to better suit Richard Dreyfuss. He had a lot of suggestions. And Spielberg thought of his character in the final production as like his alter ego on set in the story. He thought that Richard Dreyfuss just enacted a lot of different mannerisms that he himself would do in his daily life. So filming began on May 2nd of 74, and they considered Long Island. They needed a vacation area that was like lower middle class enough so that an appearance of the shark would initially destroy tourist business and potentially bankrupt the town. So the ocean at Martha's Vineyard had a sandy bottom, and it was never lower than around 35 feet for about 12 miles out from shore. So they could manipulate the shark from relative safety and you know, not too deep waters, but it could work. You could still see it the site of land was actually gone. You could go out and it would be the same depth for about 12 miles, but you would not be able to see the land. So it was perfect for trying to shoot these deep ocean scenes without putting anyone at potential risk. So Spielberg wanted a swimmer's perspective in a lot of his shots. And if you watch the movie, there's a lot of scenes of just the shark coming up onto the camera. And so to get these shots, he designed all this new cinematic equipment for marine and underwater shooting, along with the help of a cinematographer by the name of Bill Butler. And so he created this sealed box that would hold the camera, and it would also stay stable in the water despite the tide at the time. So it helped them get these steady shots of the shark while it would come up on the camera without the swaying of the tide. So they really got these terrific shots in the end. So next, we're actually going to talk about the sharks. So while you may only see the one shark on screen, there are actually three different sharks that were made for the production of Jaws. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. I am DJ Jazz. We are back talking about Jaws. So this next part that we're going to go into is actually about the three sharks, as I had mentioned before. So they were three different sharks, and they were all named Bruce after Steven Spielberg's lawyer at the time, Bruce Raymer. So the first shark was a shark that was a full body prop with the belly missing. So if you looked at it from the front, it would look like a whole shark. But if you looked at it from the side, it would just be the front half. So they would put it on a sled, and they would tow it with about 300 feet of line, and they would drag it behind the boat or up onto the camera in order to get these shots of the shark. And then they made two different platform sharks. One would move from camera left to camera right, and another that did vice versa. So one side of the shark would be, the left side of the shark would be exposed on one, and the right side would be the effect, the prop, the shark, and vice versa on the other. Because that opposite side, the one that shows what's inside, is all these pneumatic hoses and all this different machinery that would make the shark go. They were made in 1973 by art director Joe Alves at Raleigh Harper's Motion Picture and Equipment Rental in Sun Valley, California. The sharks took 40 technicians, and mechanical effects supervisor Bob Maddie also had a major part in creating the sharks, and he was known at the time for doing the effects in creature feature 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. He had created the giant squid that attacks the submarine in that movie. So they brought him on to help create the shark. So a lot of the problems in the movie came as a result of the shark. The shark would break down and not work most of the time. In fact, on delivery, when the sharks were first delivered in July, the tow platform that they were on capsized, and it required a team of divers to go in and retrieve the sharks, and they needed about 14 operators at a time in order to operate. So anytime you see the shark doing any sort of movement on screen, it takes any sort of movement takes 14 different people operating this machinery. So David Brown had stated that the budget was around $4 million, but the final movie actually costed $9 million. And the effects outlay alone cost $3 million for the shark. The shark alone, with all the problems and the effects they put into it, cost about $3 million. And so a couple of the disgruntled people that worked on the crew, nicknamed the movie Flaws because of just all the numerous problems that went on. And Spielberg attributed a lot of the problems to two different reasons. He said he attributed all the problems to his perfectionism and his inexperience. In terms of his perfectionism, he insisted that they work in the ocean with a life-size shark. He didn't want to do a swimming pool with a bigger shark, you know, to throw off the camera and make the size look different. He says, "I could have shot the movie in a tank or even in a protected lake somewhere, but it just wouldn't have looked the same." And which is very true. Any sort of lake, even large ones, wouldn't have got the choppiness of the ocean, or it probably would not have looked the same. And his lack of experience, he says he was naive about the ocean and about Mother Nature in general. The hubris of a filmmaker who thinks he can conquer the elements was foolhardy, but I was too young to know. I was being foolhardy when I demanded we shoot the film in the Atlantic Ocean and not in a North Hollywood fish tank. And so shooting at sea, the crew would always come in sunburnt, covered in sea salt. Just, they had been out at boat all day. Many of them had gotten seasick. The sailboats would get in their shot. Cameras would get soaked. One of the ships that was carrying camera equipment went down. The Orca, which is the boat which the three men go out on to catch the shark, actually began to sink when the actors were still on it. So there were just many different problems that plagued them over the course of the production. And the shark malfunctioned due to bad weather. The hoses that powered it would get salt water in them. The frames would fracture due to the resistance of the water. The skin on the outside would start corroding. It would sink, it would float, it would, the sled model would get stuck in, seaweed surrounding, where they were filming. As Spielberg says, he calculates in a 12-hour workday, they probably spent an average of 4 hours filming. So you're out there for 12 hours and you get maybe a couple shots, a couple scenes, and the rest of it is spent waiting while these technicians just dig into this shark trying to get it to work. Carl Gottlieb almost had his head taken off by a boat propeller. And the shark cage that Richard Dreyfuss goes into to try and kill the shark actually detached and started sinking, and he couldn't get out, so they needed the rescue divers to come in. And yeah, the entire crew was frequently seasick. So there were just these, all these problems that they were having. And least of all, not which, Robert Shaw would frequently fly to Canada because he was having tax problems at the time. And he also drank a lot. He would actually show up to set drunk. And on one occasion, he actually showed up really drunk and basically made a fool of himself. And so the next day, he calls Steven Spielberg in the morning, and he asks him, how badly did I do yesterday? And Steven Spielberg waits for a second, and he says he thought about it, and he told him, not fatally, which basically meant, okay, you screwed up, but if you can get it together, I'll allow you to continue filming. So he did. He got himself a little bit better and would show up to set ready to film. And he also held a grudge against Richard Dreyfuss, who played the role of Matt Hooper. And in the actual story and in the actual movie, the roles of Quint and Hooper, they butt heads a lot, their characters. Hooper and Quint come to blows many times in the movie, and they argue a lot. And there's just many scenes where they're butting heads. And so offset, that was actually very true in terms of Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss. Roy Scheider would say, Shaw would say, look at you, Dreyfuss, you eat and drink and you're fat and you're sloppy. At your age, it's criminal. You can't even do 10 good pushups, can you? So just like really childish stuff. Like he would just get drunk on set and then just start poking fun at Richard Dreyfuss. In fact, Shaw actually once told Dreyfuss if he climbed up to the mast of the Orca and jumped into the water, he would pay him $100. So just all these different confrontations offset and while they were, you know, on set just waiting around, transferred into their performances. And it actually really enhances their performances in the long run. So with all these problems, you know, they were able to refine the script a lot because the production itself was taking a long time. So in that time, they were able to go back and rewrite the script several times and add and subtract several things. And the unreliability of the shark forced that them to hint at it on screen instead of just show it outright. If you watch the shark hunt, when they're chasing the shark, most of the scenes you see it, you just see the barrels which are harpooned to the shark just skimming along the water. In the opening, when the girl is initially attacked, you just see her being dragged through the water. And that scene was originally written to show the shark coming up and actually just like swallowing her whole or just like devouring her. They had to include numerous shots of just the dorsal fin of the shark, just the big back fin, to just suggest that the shark was there because they couldn't get the actual shark itself working. And so what this is called, this sort of hinting at the monster on screen and not actually showing him, it's called forced restraint. And this sort of forced restraint helped add to the film's suspense as a horror movie, and it ultimately helped add to its success in the long run. The more fake the shark looked in the water, the more anxious Lucas would get, and it really forced him to also heighten and promote the actors to heighten their performances on set. So as a result of the shark, Spielberg being afraid that the shark looked fake or just not realistic enough, promoted him to and the actors to make their performances A+. They performed excellency because they needed to in order to make up for other problems which were going on set. So as I mentioned before, they actually had real shark footage, which was shot by Ron and Valerie Tyson off Dangerous Reef in South Australia. Dangerous Reef, yeah, they couldn't come up with a better name for that one. They had a miniaturized shark cage and a miniaturized Richard Dreyfuss so that any shark that would show up would be appear bigger. So the sharks that would show up would maybe be around 15, 17 feet, But because the cage had been shrunk as well as a figurine, it made the shark look like it was the 25 3-ton shark which was attacking the boat. So while they were filming, a shark actually attacked the miniature cage and the boat, and Spielberg was really eager to use the footage, but they didn't have the figurine of Dreyfus in the cage. So as a result, the script had originally followed the book in which Hooper's killed by the shark. And as a result of them getting this really good footage but not having Hooper in the cage, they rewrote the script so that Hooper escapes the cage and then hides in the coral reefs below the boat until the shark is destroyed. And then he comes out and him and Brody swim back to shore. So as a result of this problem in production, it actually saved a character's life on screen. They had to rewrite it so that a character actually survived instead of being killed by the beast, which was originally in the book. So they were scheduled around 55 days to take the film. I had mentioned this earlier. And it took them around 159 days to complete. So Spielberg thought his career as a filmmaker was over. He said, "I heard rumors that I would never work again. No one had ever taken a film 100 days over schedule before," which, you know, that can be really bad. If you've got an assignment to turn in on Monday and you don't turn it in until 2 months later, you're obviously not going to be in that class for very long. So he was actually gone. Spielberg, he was actually gone during the final scene of the movie, which is the shark's death. Because he said he believed the crew was going to throw him into the water because of all the trouble. And so as a result, it's actually became a tradition for Steven Spielberg to be absent on the final shoot or the final scene of whatever movie he's filming. Another interesting habit that Steven Spielberg has is that if you watch most of his movies, he'll actually have a shooting star somewhere in the movie. In Jaws, there's two. And they come at the part where I'd mentioned before they had been drinking in the cabin and the shark comes and starts banging on the ship. When they all go out on deck, Brody looks in his bag and finds he's got his service pistol because he's a police chief. And when he kind of looks out onto the water, there's a shooting star in the background. And then they show a big wide shot of the boat and there's another shooting star. But if you watch like Star Wars is kind of hard to find, but if you watch like Indiana Jones or some of his other movies, there are actually shooting stars in the background. It's a sort of trademark of Steven Spielberg's to add a shooting star in the background of his movies. So when we get back, we're going to talk some more about the production, including the score, which is so famous. So until then, you are listening to The Premiere. I am DJ Jazz, and this is radio.dominican.edu.
To you by Penguin Radio. Did you know that Dominican University is 12 miles from San Francisco and is on 80 wooded acres with 220 species of trees, including redwoods, dogwoods, coast live oaks, and bay trees? Did You Know is brought to you by the DJs of Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu.
All right, everybody, we're back. We're going to talk some more about Jaws. The audience, for instance, would scream too loud when Scheider's bigger boat line would come on. So Scheider has a very famous line, which is, "You're going to need a bigger boat." And when they did their test screenings, they noticed that the audience would still be screaming when he gives his line. So they decided to elongate his reaction so that people would be able to hear the line, and now it's become very famous. They changed a couple comedy scenes over to horror scenes, just because they would take in or put in music or change the lighting or change the time that cuts were. Some scenes that were shot in order to be funny actually changed to horror shots. And Spielberg actually wanted to add one last scream into the movie, which, if you've seen it, is the scene where they come across Hooper and Brody come across a sunken boat and decide to investigate, and they find a head basically in the sunken boat. And so the way they filmed it is Spielberg put down $3,000 of his own money because Universal wouldn't pay, and they shot it in a crew member's pool in Encino, California, and to simulate the murky night water of Martha's Vineyard, they threw powdered milk mix into the pool, and then they covered the pool with a tarp, and then they would just put the cameras into the pool. So it's just really interesting. He dropped $3,000 of his own money to add one last scene. And if you watch the scene, it's just a simple scare. It's like to get one last jump out of the audience. So the score, as I mentioned before, John Williams, the score got him an Academy Award, and it was ranked as the sixth greatest score by the American Film Institute. And he describes it as grinding away at you, and just as the shark in the movie does. It's instinctual and relentless, and it makes you feel like whatever's coming is unstoppable. Just the simple two notes. There have been a lot of people who speculate over, you know, what it's supposed to be. Is it the shark's heart? Is it the swimmer's heart? Or is it the person breathing? The audience is actually, someone had brought up, the audience is actually conditioned to associate the theme song with the shark. So there are scenes when the shark actually appears on screen with no music. And when it does, it only heightens your reaction when the shark pops up. When the shark comes out of the water, if there's no intro to it, it really makes you jump if you've never seen the movie before. So Spielberg actually felt that without the movie, or without the score, the movie would only be half as successful. And Williams, in return, credited the score for jumpstarting his career. So Universal actually spent about $1.8 million promoting Jaws, and $700,000 of that was on national TV advertising. And so at the time, Universal chairman Lou Wasserman had come to one of the film's screenings, and he ordered the initial release, and he wanted it to be in several hundred theaters. And at the time, the wide release of movies, like on a grand scale, meant that they were really doubtful quality. And you would typically open a movie that you wanted to sell fast or that you thought was a good movie in a few big city theaters across the country, and then you would slowly forward the prints to locations out across the U.S. Godfather, which had come out in 1972, had changed it slightly because it had grown so rapidly. So many people loved it. But it was only in about five theaters before it actually went wide its second week. So it opened on, Jaws opened on June 20th in about 464 theaters across the North America, 409 in the U.S., and it earned $7 million in its first weekend and paid off all production costs within 2 weeks of its release. In 78 days, it overtook The Godfather as the highest grossing film at the North American box office. And Spielberg was actually concerned when it initially came out because he had attended one of the original showings of the movie. And during the scene when a boy is actually taken off a raft by the shark, and there's lots of blood, but I mean, if you watch it, obviously it's a movie, you know he's all right, but this kid is taken off a raft by the shark, and there's lots of blood. And when he was watching it, he said he was in the back of the theater, and he saw a man stand up and start walking out. And he thought, oh no, this is the first walkout. And so he watched him, and as the guy moved down the aisle, he actually started running. And Steven Spielberg was like, he's running out. So he follows him into the lobby, and he watches this guy try and get to the bathroom, not make it to the bathroom, and actually throw up on the lobby of the movie theater, the floor. And at that point, his first reaction was that he should have edited the film more, because he thought that this was going to happen in every movie theater that Jaws premiered in, that someone was going to get sick or someone was going to outright hate the movie. But in return, it turns out to be really like one of the first blockbusters. And it also establishes summertime, as a time to release movies that you want to do well, or movies that you think are your box office smashes. Jaws actually earned around $2 billion worldwide, adjusted for inflation, and it was the second most successful franchise film after Star Wars. And years later, in 1979, when ABC actually premiered the movie on TV, the first U.S. broadcast attracted 57% of their total audience. So 57% of their audience was just all watching Jaws. It got mostly positive reviews, an exhilarating adventure, entertainment of the highest order, extraordinary technical achievements. Most of the negative reviews came at the expense of the shark and its appearance, and they discredited it and called it, you know, a creature feature or a monster movie. Something like the old Godzilla movies you'll see, where it's just guys in suits kind of hacking away at each other in little miniaturized Tokyo or miniaturized outskirts of town, stuff like that. Jaws won 3 Academy Awards. They won it for Best Film Editing, Best Original Dramatic Score, and Best Sound. It was in Best Picture, but it lost to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a good movie with Jack Nicholson. It's him in an insane asylum with some other characters. It's a more serious movie, but it's a good movie. And Spielberg was actually not nominated for Best Director when it came out, which he was not really happy about. In the years after, it's frequently been cited as one of the greatest films of all time. And in 2001, the United States Library of Congress actually selected the movie for preservation in the National Film Registry, titling it as culturally significant to the generation and to the country. So Jaws as a legacy it's a very good movie, and many people have taken note from it and taken pieces from it to create their own movies. But Jaws also caused many people to fear the ocean, and in 1975 there was a lot of reduced beach attendance. And it's seen as responsible for perpetuating a lot of negative stereotypes about sharks. Which shows in events like Shark Week is trying to tell people that sharks are endangered. And it inspired a lot of fishermen who would get in boats and just go out hunting for shark in shark hunting tournaments. And Benchley actually stated he wouldn't have written the novel if he actually knew the truth about how sharks are in the wild. And Jaws actually, as a result, inspired many future horror films. To the point where Ridley Scott, another famous director, when he pitched Alien with Sigourney Weaver, good movie, in 1979 to executives, he titled it or pitched it as Jaws in Space. So that's the closest thing he could think of to his movie. So it looks like we're just about out of time. It's been nice being able to talk about Jaws and all things like that. Maybe stay away from the beaches this weekend, I don't know. But until next time, this has been DJ Jazz at the premiere, and you've been listening to radio.dominican.edu.